Okay, let's go ahead and get started.
This semester, our class sessions are shorter, so we don't want to lose time since we get 55 minutes and then we're out. So today, we're talking about punitive damages. One thing is, punitive damages is something you generally hear about outside of law school. What you need to do is take everything you hear about and put it out of your mind. Because normally the stuff you hear about is actually vastly wrong. Like you'll hear, like, there's thousands of punitive damages at war, and they're running away. And we can have a critique about whether that's actually true or not. But the reality is, in most cases, you know, there's very, very, very limited punitive damages. Less than 5% in all damages cases that are awarded are punitive damages awarded. In negligence actions, it's even smaller than that. So normally punitives are awarded in what kinds of cases? What do you think?
Not negligence. Typically intentional torts and specific kinds of intentional torts. One generally where the compensatory injury is low. So it's actually not generally awarded when you have, like, you know, the battery with the baseball bat and hits you, but more of the kind where it's the offensive touching, the things that are like an impact on your sense of dignity. And the reason we typically do that is because your damages, your compensatory damages in those cases, tend to be pretty nominal. Like, you really didn't suffer any harm. There's nothing. You didn't have to go to the doctor because they gave you that weirdo shoulder massage we learn about in class when we study battery. But it's a real, damage to your psyche, to your dignity, and so that's where the punitive damages are intended to come in. The other ones we typically see them are for business torts, which you would take if you took an advanced torts class. You study those there. For people who really want to do a lot of transactional work, you can learn those there. Those are like fraud claims, interference with a business contract. You took my good leads, you went and took away my contract. That was my client, you took them and you did it wrongly. There's not a lot of real hard damage there, so punitives tend to deter that behavior. We're going to see the kind of cases you see them in negligence in this section. They put it here because it's easiest to understand them in comparison to compensatory. They're typically not awarded in negligence kinds of actions. I'm sorry?
Repeat offenders?
Mm-mm. Because even in torts, we don't have such a concept. If you think about it, you've got a civil action. It's between these two individuals. Even if there's multiple civil actions against this individual, in like a class action, normally punitives are really limited there. You just don't. And in fact, the hard part is for people who are on the hook for potential punitives against one defendant, like that hotel case we have here, there's nothing procedurally that would stop others from also trying to sue and get recovery for punitives. They don't even look at it. Like, it didn't happen because it's not binding in this case and it's not going to be relevant. It can be a totally different jurisdiction. We're not going to even talk about it. So, no, not really. It's typically because the injury itself isn't something that's going to provide enough deterrence, the compensatory aspect. That's typically why civil law allows punitives. But we'll talk about these two cases. All right. Let's talk about the National Byproducts case versus Searcy House Moving Company. This one kind of has some complex facts and also some complex process because there's certain people in this suit, certain plaintiffs or basically decedent's estates that I think you could actually very clearly see why there's the punitives there and then other people who are actually party to the action who are really the ones we're going to focus on. All right, so here we have Foley, who's our truck driver. He's an employee of the National Byproducts Incorporated, and he's driving a tractor-trailer truck. Our plaintiff in this action is Searcy, who is the one who actually, in their own negligence, caused a house they were towing to get stuck under a bridge that was spanning over a 4-lane highway. So the house is blocking one lane, and traffic was being, through the use of a flagman, deterred around the house into the open lane. And a car driven by McGee and Staggs it started to move in this open lane when Foley struck it from behind. And it basically launches the car like 80 feet. It smacks, arguably we think, into Searcy's trailer. Those two individuals either die in impact or later die. But they're not really the ones that are subject part of our suit. It's Searcy, the one who has the house that's stuck under the bridge, who's the plaintiff we're really worried about. Now, while it doesn't tell us exactly what happened to Searcy's property, it's pretty clear that it wasn't significant damage, because if you look at how the award was broken down by the jury, that's what it seems to reflect. So all three, the estates and the wrongful death of the two people in the car, and the people who got the
house stuck under the bridge. Sue, national byproduct. So think about it. We've got the driver who's not really a party to the suit, but is the source of the liability. It's his employer that's getting sued. All right? There's vicarious liability by the two people who died in the car accident and by the guy in the company who got stuck under the bridge. All right, so who does the jury award damages to? Well, first off, we have the damages awarded to McGee and Staggs. And how much did they get? In compensatories. Let's just talk compensatories first.
$3 million.
Okay, so those damages are to the estates. That's what they're recouping. And we'll talk later in the semester when we get to wrongful death actions, how they qualify or quantify those kinds of injuries. But those are compensatory, so, you know, medical treatment if they had any at the time, but most of it's likely going to be recouped is, like, the earning power that the estate and the dependents would have gotten from them. That's what they get in their pain and suffering during the collision. What does Searcy get in compensatories? $15,000. All right, so that's why we know that what happened when a tractor trailer hits you, you only have $15,000 compensatory. Arguably, it wasn't, like, the major source of the damage in this action, all right? We don't know exactly what the damage was, but arguably we can assume it's property since it's the company suing the other company. They lost part of their property. All right, but the something happens is compensatory award, before we get to punitives, what happens to Searcy's compensatory award? It's kind of a reminder from last week, yeah, or from Monday, yeah.
Just a
Okay, so this one is written in the opposite effect than our last one is. So the remittitor here is actually $13,000, and it goes down to just a little under $2,000. All right, so the last one, it was we took a remittitor of $250,000, so you subtracted that from the total judgment. Here they said the remittitor was $2,000, which means that's where we landed. So that's how you read these things. The different courts write about it in different ways. Why did they go there? Well, that's what they had stipulated to. Some agreement they had, probably like a high-low agreement you can go into verdicts with. But either way, that's if they get compensatory. So we're only talking like $2,000. All right, so really we know that the property damage was pretty small. Pretty small. But what punitive damages does everybody get? What do the car victims get? $100,000. What does Searcy get?
$100,000.
So the one that we're seeing on appeal, it's not the punitives as awarded to the drivers of the car and the passenger in the car. It's as to Searcy, the $100,000 on top of a $2,000, a little less than $2,000 compensatory judgment. All right, so here the Supreme Court strikes the punitive award to Searcy, and what you should focus on, unlike the cases on Monday, this is a challenge as a matter of law. They're not saying that the damages were excessive. It's not like saying $100,000 is excessive in this situation. What they're saying is you can't recover legally because you haven't showed the proof necessary to even be entitled to any punitive damages, any, let alone $100,000. So it's a matter of law as to did you show the standard to get punitive damages. All right, so let's focus on what the test is. If you look at 486, we're going to highlight two places in our casebook that gives us the test, and then I broke down for you what normally is considered underneath that test. So this isn't the test outright. It's just examples of what we see. So if you look at the top of 486, it tells us what you have to prove in this jurisdiction to get punitives. What do you typically have to prove? What's the standard here?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so where do you see willful? Willfulness or consciousness? Okay, and the one thing I would note is they're not using the word willful here as we did like an intentional torts. They're actually meaning like the conscious awareness of the harm. So the best words to pick up on are wantonness. That's what we're talking about here. Because true deliberateness would be like you'd say Foley battered me by intentionally driving the tractor trailer truck. And that's not what we're really talking about. We're saying that he was negligent in doing that, but it was more than just your average negligence. At least that's what we're trying to prove to the plaintiff. It was like behavior that was really abhorrent, was wanton, but not at the level of like willful intentional tort. Does that make sense? Like willful conscious. Okay? So the first part, the very first little paragraph at the top of the page is actually our test, where it says, indicates that the defendant acted wantonly in causing the injury or with such conscious indifference to the consequences that malice may be inferred. And so they're trying to, those are the, what we're going to see our two pieces come out of. Later down in the section, that's the second indented excerpt from Freeman, they give us a little bit more clarification of what that standard is. So if you look at the highlighted section that the casebook author highlights with italics, if you want to star that, that's the other portion of the standard. They say, well, what is wanton in causing the injury or conscious indifference to the consequences that malice may be inferred mean? And they tell us it means it must appear that the negligent party knew or had reason to believe that his act of negligence was about to inflict injury, and that he continued in his course with a conscious indifference to the consequences. So those are the two sections you want highlighted. Now, most jurisdictions, that breaks out into two different kinds of wanton behavior. The first is called wanton disregard. In some jurisdictions, they actually call it reckless disregard. It's the same thing. This jurisdiction used reckless to mean something less than wanton, so that's why they kind of say, oh, it's not gross negligence, it's not recklessness. But in some jurisdictions, when they use the word gross negligence or when they use the word reckless, they actually mean wantonness. So how's that for confusing? So make sure when you look at your jurisdiction, you understand that those terms might mean the same thing, even though the other jurisdiction says that's not what we mean by that term. All right, so here's a good general one for us to use. Wanton disregard for others' well-being. In general, here's what the defendant has reason to know, but typically doesn't actually know. Not like proof of actual knowledge, just has reason to know of some facts which would lead an otherwise reasonable person to realize that the dangers that are attendant with his conduct are there and to take a different course of action. So who are we really trying to net with this? Well, an example is someone who fails to appreciate the dangers because they're just very reckless temperamentally. So like the person who's like, I love to risk it. I speed on the highway because I'm a great driver and the laws of physics don't really apply to me. And meet anyone like that ever? You know, like the one who's just like never going to get in an accident, that kind of person. You know what I'm talking about? That's what this is. That's the wanton disregard in this kind of situation. Like the, I can maneuver, I'm always ahead of everything, those other things that the average person has to do, I don't. There's someone who probably should know, and a reasonable person would say, hey, there's some high danger attendant to my conduct here, and I should change my course of behavior. But these are just the reckless individuals. You know, they just are. I'm getting blank stares. You know what kind of behavior I'm talking about? Okay, good. The second one, I'm sorry.
Everyone's judging their own driving.
Yeah. I'm sure none of you, like, but you know what I mean? Like, if you've ever just driven on the highway and you're like, whoa, who's this guy? And it's like speeding. That's the kind of person we're
going.
Yeah, like, it snows. And these are my favorite people. Like, I really want to demonstrate how reckless I am. Now that it's inclement weather, I'm going to kick it up and notch, really. You know what I mean? Those kind of people. They sort of are just like their natural predisposition is to take a lot of risks. The risk lover. That's who this is. Okay. So when they injure people, we're like, all right, you're not just negligent. You are like inviting this harm almost by your behavior. These people are different. Now realize they're both going to get punitive damages. It doesn't really matter which one you're under. But the reason we like to split these out is it helps you issue spot the different kinds of punitive damage behavior. The second is deliberate indifference. So now there's some more purpose to it. So here it's not just that you had reason to know and you think like you can get around stuff, but rather that you're aware that your conduct creates an unreasonable risk of harm and that that risk is substantially greater than that which is necessary to make the conduct careless. All right, and we'll get to an example about this. Basically, these are people who know that what they're doing is actually going to increase the likelihood of a risk of harm. I know it's really risky, and I'm going to do it anyway. The first ones are just like, you know, I think I can be above risk. I'm just alter careless is my natural predisposition. The second one's almost like taken up, and you'll see the difference between our two cases. The one that we're reading now fits in one of these. The Matthias case fits in the other. And so you'll see an example. All right, first of all, does the court here conclude that either form of these wantonness are shown in this case? they say, oh, this is a situation of deliberate indifference, or this is a situation of wanton disregard for another's well-being. Yeah?
They seem to say that he had no idea that he was being reckless.
Do they go that far and say he has no idea if he's being reckless?
They don't. I think they kind of say that he had no reason. They kind of say that he wasn't really.
Yeah, they're definitely saying he's not being wanton here,
yeah.
That he didn't necessarily have the reason to know of facts here, or that a reasonable jury couldn't have concluded that he should have or had reason to know of his carelessness.
Based on what we're reading here, it sounds like he's kind of almost acting like he's above the law. It's like he's breaking company rules all the time and he's getting away with it, and the company's really kind of not taking care of him, so it's like maybe he's being wanton, but... The way I'm reading it, it's like they're saying we're never going to be able to prove it.
Okay.
Because of how bad the company is.
Okay, well, let's just for a moment break this down by looking at the evidence they have, and then we can talk about how it kind of relates to these standards. I mean, in general, between the two, it's going to be much harder based on what Foley did to show deliberate indifference. I mean, deliberative indifference is like they're actually aware of it and have just decided that that risk is an okay risk to assume. And I doubt that he's, like, at that level. That would be, like, that intentionally trying to hurt them. But, I mean, in the end, I think they actually have a pretty decent case for this, although the court doesn't agree for the wanton disregard. So let's talk about what he did. What's his behavior? What were the things that he did?
He was speeding down the middle.
Okay, one thing he's doing is speeding. And I'm actually going to put that because it's, like, a chain of events. It's actually our last one. When he hits the car at 70 miles per hour. All right, but there's a lot of things he's doing even before he gets the 70 mile per hour impact. Yeah.
He overloads his truck by, I think it was 480 pounds.
Okay, so we've got an overloaded truck.
Sorry.
Huh?
480 pounds, yeah.
Yeah. So overloaded truck. Hand up there. Is that the hand up there? Did you want?
Oh, no, that was mine.
Okay. Yeah.
He's tailgating.
He's tailgating. And this is like all the same event. We're not saying it's someday he tailgated, someday an overloaded truck. Like you're trying to picture, like, you know, it's like the math problem. Assume the driver A leaves point of origin with an overloaded truck while tailgating, and what's the next thing he does? What else does he do? I'm sorry? His brakes had no effect. Brake application is actually, this was closer to the 70 miles per hour. Impact, the brake application has no effect. In part because one of his, you know, like the brake pad is even touching the part that needs to in order to actually stop the.
Were there facts for that? That brakes are actually.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. After the fact, they actually showed out of all the brakes in the back, four of which did not function correctly. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
He left late. He was already behind schedule.
Okay. So I think that one that we kind of included this one in the speeding because I think that's motivation. It's not so much like a wanton behavior, evidence of wanton behavior. Just being late isn't. But the decision to speed is, and that's, I think, his motivation. Right? There's one other thing that it deals with, like what he sees and all this happening. These up because we're going to put three in here, and this is the last one. Is he has an unobstructed view. What is he looking at, by the way?
He passed the car with flashing lights.
Yeah. Well, he passed the car with flashing lights. He has an unobstructed view of the bridge with a house stuck in it. And, like, you know, one lane being obstructed. How far away was this unobstructed view? Does anyone give me an approximation? We're looking at how much?
Could be seen from about 900 feet.
Yeah, which is, like, how far?
Third of a football field.
A fifth of a mile.
Yeah, I got a fifth of a mile. They're actually yeah, I was going to say, I'm like, that's actually two football fields. Isn't it?
Three.
No, the, like, the testimony. Yeah, but I don't think that's what the conflict, the actual testimony in the end was approximately closer to 200. So you had different people testifying to how far it was. So even if you take the, like, the most favorable to him, the closest view were 2 football lengths. If you take the least favorable to him, we're about 3 football lengths. So you're looking anywhere between 3 to 2 football lengths. And so at that point, like, we really don't know. Like, he just either didn't apply the brake, or he tried to apply the brake and it didn't work. Because it's, like, it's a pretty high speed to hit someone in this situation. All right, so let's talk through, you know, why the majority comes out the way it does. I mean, how do you justify looking at this, that no reasonable jury could have looked at this and concluded it was wanton disregard, that you had reason to know, based on what we see, of facts which will lead a reasonable person to realize the dangers and attend to them. We realize this is more than just basic negligence, where you're kind of hindsight going, oh, it was unreasonable. But this you're saying is an individual who, in that moment, should have chosen different behavior because it was so basically obvious. And that's why we want to apply punitive damages. You know, why does the majority look at this and say, realize the dissent doesn't, but the majority look at this and say it's not anything a reasonable jury can conclude is wanton?
It seems like they put a lot of
Yeah, so I think a lot of the opinion here is about where they're attributing the source of the accident, that it's unexpected brake failure, that he erred in relying on either his ability to brake last minute, either because he couldn't stop fast at his speed or because they weren't working. But it doesn't seem unreasonable, if you look at it, to think the jury could believe that Foley had some reason to believe his brakes would fail. In fact, there was a lot of testimony suggests that they'd had problems with the brakes, that there had been adjustments to them, that there was an actual process by which the company suggested they should be checking in on their brakes that he didn't. So it's you know, even if you look at it that way, and I think that's probably the most plausible explanation for what happened, because everything else makes him look just absolutely crazy. That it doesn't seem like something you would take from a jury. So we'll kind of figure out what, maybe why their motivations were that way, but I think their reasoning has to be that way. Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, arguably, if you don't think it's accidental, what conclusion are you left with about Foley? Then intentionally, what do you think about that kind of behavior? It's crazy. It's criminal. It's probably suicidal. I mean, really think about it. It's not just harming other people. I mean, he's driving in a tractor trailer truck. It's not like, well, I'll just be free of impact if I plow into this car and a sandwich taps. You know, so it's like you almost have to be at that level to think that it was non-accidental. Chip your hand.
The two individuals that were killed, they got their estates kept punitive damages.
Yes, because the defendant doesn't appeal against them.
So, okay.
They could have. They chose not to, and probably because the rationale that they're employing against this particular plaintiff really wouldn't be well suited as against them.
So it's not the difference that the damage is done to property in one and the other two.
Well, that could be arguably a reason to justify why the majority treats them differently and why the defendant probably chose not to try and quibble with $100,000 punitives against the people who were killed. You know, but there's nothing in the law that specifically states that punitive damages cannot be applied to a property loss. Because really what you're trying to do is look at the behavior that you had reason to know of a particular harm and you chose basically not to do anything about it. It doesn't have to do with the harm being a physical injury versus the harm being one of property damage. But I think that is something, like, it's in my little list of maybe that's what the majority is really taking into account here.
So they would use the same argument if they're going to argue the damages regarding the two estates, but they just know that...
That's stupid. Yes, that there's no way. I mean, it's not even a huge punitive. I mean, if we think about it in comparison to the actual compensatory damages, which are not contesting, that the people, the decedent's estates had, I mean, $100,000 punitive is just tiny you know, so it's just not worth it. In fact, I think it actually, if you were the lawyer advising them on this, I think if you had coupled the arguments together and said we shouldn't have got punitives to anybody, then that wrongfulness, I think, that's so apparent as against the individuals who you just plowed into and killed would be imputed to everybody. You would have probably lost everything. Here they at least saved $100,000 against the property damage. And realize, you know, you're talking about, like, minimal compensatory property damage. And I think that that probably in some way weighed on their mind. Is that what the black letter law says? No. But that's one reason, like, this is a weird case. And I would have actually argued that that's one reason the majority is coming out the way they do. I think primarily it's because they think it's a brake failure and not more of, like, potentially reason to know. Although, arguably, I think there was enough for the jury to have ruled on that one way or another, and they don't let them. All right, what else is interesting about this? Do you have to believe, if it is an accidental, that he's really, like, suicidal? No. I think under many cases, courts have sent these to the jury on the reasoning that this is supposed to net those people who are wildly optimistic about their abilities and are just really reckless people. And that could have been a theory of argument that they presented for why the jury verdict should have been upheld. The jury considered that and said, no, he isn't that level of crazy. He's just very risky. We need to deter that kind of behavior. Let's see, what else? One other thing that they might have been thinking is that the court might have been reluctant to permit multiple punitive damages awards for one suit. Because you're thinking about it, it's just one action, one piece of conduct that you're actually netting all of these damages for. And so they might have thought that's over deterrence, over punishment, especially in light of the fact that this one is only for the small property loss as opposed to loss of human life. There's one other reason I think the majority might have come out the way it did, and that is, I think, if you look at who's actually on the hook for these damages. Who has to pay these out? Hmm? Yeah, the company has to pay it out. The National Byproduct actually has to pay out this. Now, how does that kind of work into potentially coloring the majority's view of the verdict here? Who's really the person who's most culpable? Well, yeah, because you're not supposed to go after people just because they have the ability. You know, the law is supposed to treat everybody fairly. You don't just say, we're going to award more punitive damages against you because you make more money. When we get to the next case, when Posner starts talking about the wherewithal of, you know, Motel 6, he mentions their, you know, their worth. But he's not doing it to suggest that because they're worth a lot, they automatically should be more on the hook. It's just more that they were able to use really evasive litigation tactics because they're suing that such plaintiffs who could never, you know, pony up what they could in the kind of litigation tactics. So, but, you know, so part of it that. So if you think about it, not necessarily the pocket part, but whose behavior is really the one that's had, you know, they had reason to know of the facts and could lead a reasonable person based on the theory in this case? How are they pursuing this claim? Yeah. How are they pursuing this claim? What was their theory here? They did what? Yeah.
That it was really Polley's fault, not the company's.
Okay.
Like they don't want to go after the company for it because they don't really want
to
fall.
Okay, so if you were to change the theory of argumentation and make it more of the negligence of National Byproduct, what would it look like? Yeah.
Talk about they did a lot of things wrong. They had all the policy and pricing completely keep breaking. They didn't expect the brakes were supposed to on time. They missed that a couple times. They were supposed to have a policy and pricing discipline their drivers when they have driver load trucks. They missed that 6 times and they were talking about it. Some of the carelessness is intentional because it's cheaper not to service the trucks. It's also better for them if their driver to drive a load of trucks to get more stuff.
It looks like the majority either didn't have that argument really presented to it, but that wasn't really was the thrust of the argument to support the punitive damages. Because I think if you look at it more of, look, you're the one that's failing to train, you're the one that's failing to supervise, then it really is more related to your behavior. If you look at the case, however, as being like Foley, this out-of-control driver, who didn't even have a reason to know about his brakes, but it just happened, then it's much harder to try and attribute this damage to the defendant, which is the employee. Even though vicariously it's going to be imposed on him, that makes sense for compensation, but not necessarily for punishment. But if you do agree it's like you failed to train, you failed to supervise, then it seems like it's a better fit. So it seems like the majority was more persuaded by it's Foley and not it's National Byproducts that caused this actually to happen as far as their negligent behavior. All right, so if you were to look at this case and put it as an example of wanton disregard for others' well-being or deliberate indifference, it goes in the top one. It is an example of what a court and a dissenter disagree about, whether it hits wanton disregard. This one's pretty much on the extreme, though. I mean, that's pretty wanton to not get it to at least go to a jury. But it didn't. At least they stripped the verdict. All right, the next case, Mathias versus Zacher Economy Lodging Incorporated, makes me itch just to talk about it, so I apologize, because it's just like every time I have to teach this case, I start just, because it's just the heebie-jeebies kind of case. Here you go. This is a very, very famous case, and in fact, if you take remedies, you'd likely read it in most remedies case books. It's written by Posner. Have you guys heard of Posner? Posner is very Posner-esque in this particular opinion. So everything comes back to an economic value, and he uses really obtuse language to state obvious contention. So that's Posner. He gives us an economic or deterrence-based approach to punitives, and that's what it's famous for, is that economic rationale for why we should support punitive damages in certain kind of cases. So this one is an example of deliberate indifference. And it's also an example where you need to go to for a lot of the policy to support why punitive damages are permissible. So that you can distinguish in cases where you would suggest they're less permissible than in cases like this where they're more permissible. All right, so what happened in this horrible case? What happened here? Starts off at the hotel. Yeah. Sprinkle.
My brother and sister go to Chicago. They're going to
Yep. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what the hotel actually was aware of, what they did. Because remember, with deliberate indifference, it's not just you had reason to know, like, oh, there was some evidence that should have raised your awareness, but that you're actually aware of the risks you're creating. Or
they knew many prior occasions that there were bed bugs they had.
Yeah, what was the evidence of how they knew about it on prior occasions?
Guests being bit by insects and demanding their refunds.
Yeah, so lots of refunds, you know, the best way to run a business. Be like, oh yeah, we'll refund everyone bug bites. but I think in their mind, they're probably thinking it's still worth it, the refund we lose on the room, because arguably, you know, you're not going to be like, it's not like our bed and breakfast you're coming back to each year. Like, there's always going to be demand. This is in downtown Chicago. If you're in the, this particular hotel right now is a Red Roof Inn, and it's right, travel out there, but it's right near the major tourist district, very close to Magnificent Mile. I mean, there's just always demand for hotels. And they actually charge quite a lot for being an economy kind of hotel. So they just know, like, you know, if I give you a refund, you're likely never to come back. But I got plenty of other people from all over that you're never going to talk to or are going to come to the hotel. All right. Even in the age of internet, we can just deal with it. It doesn't really matter. All right, so people were complaining. Why else did they know that there was the...
They did call in experts, discriminators, Ecolab to assess the sex situation.
Yeah, the first one, they're like, hey, come look at the room, and they told them what was it. Bed bugs. Mm-hmm. And so they say one thing about bed bugs is once you have bed bugs everywhere, which is why, like, you never want to stay in a hotel with bed bugs. You don't want to bring your hotel stuff in from bed bug rooms because they're really hard little things to get rid of. As they said, we don't want to just, you know, spray a room. What should we do?
They didn't have to spray the whole building, close the entire hotel in town.
And that would cost like $1 million? At least $100,000? $500. $500. That's just for the spray. We don't. I mean, they would have lost significantly more for closing down the hotel for the time that they'd have to fumigate. But I mean, we're not talking about like outrageous amounts of money to get rid of the bed bug problem. Yes.
But it was $500.
No, it was $500 for the building. Which is why Posner's like tisk tisk tisk. This is not economically feasible. He loves that. Like if you can work it down to, we'll talk to the per room value, but it wasn't the $500. The fumigation fee was $500. All right. So we've got. I'm already itching. Okay. So we've got the that part of it. What other evidence do we have? Yeah. Yeah, and this is one of, like, Posner from his lofty perch tells us, And in actuality, even though the most stupid people coming into the hotel wouldn't know that that's actually worse, it technically is. Ticks are actually more dangerous. And so I don't know why they said that the best way to handle it is to tell everybody we have a tick problem. So I don't know about you, but I would have been like, oh, well, yeah, the tick problem. No problem at all. I mean, regardless of whether or not they carry Lyme disease, it's still kind of icky. All right. I think it's just bed bugs has a worse, I guess, image it raises in people's minds than ticks. But whatever, that's what they did. They also have one other piece of evidence that shows about their awareness. Yeah.
That they also had some do not rent status for certain rooms that had the bed bugs, and even though they had that, they still rented them.
In fact, they rented one of those to these people. Like, it was like when they check in, they're like, ooh, that room's infested with bugs. And it wasn't like, you know, let's write next to it, room unavailable. It says on it, like, bugs are in this room. You know, don't rent it out till it's fixed. And they're like, well, we're at max tonight, so you're living in the bug room. So they basically check these people in knowing full well that they would very likely get bit by bed bugs, and that all they would do is say, gosh, we're so sorry for your inconvenience tonight. Here's a refund and a free stay in one of our non-bug rooms somewhere else. So again, I'm just kidding. All right. So we get to this point. What does the jury award these individuals?
$186,000.
Yeah, and what do they award them in compensatory? $5,000, which comes to a total of $191,000. That's become important in a moment. $191,000 is the total award. Okay, we got $5,000 in compensatory, and $186,000 in. All right, so here, the defendant argues on appeal that at most they're just basically negligent and that the plaintiff shouldn't be entitled at all to punitive damages. What does the court think? Do they think that there's no evidence of wantonness here? Is this just average negligence, like, oops, it's unreasonable and I have the risk of foreseeable harm?
Was this before they stopped laughing?
I don't know. But here it's clearly not just simple inadvertence. Here we've got a lot of knowledge, and that's why they trot through all those facts. I mean, I think the most damning piece is literally labeling on the room that they put these people into. Bugs are here with a big circle on it. But aside from that, there was actually a lot of awareness at this point in time. I think even if you went back to where the exterminator said you have to do the whole building or it won't go away, arguably still renting rooms after that would probably have been deliberate indifference. But certainly as they keep getting complaints, each piece just adds more to the claim they have here. All right. At least this is conscious indifference, and at worst it's actually a battery, because you might be getting at the point where you have substantial knowledge of substantial certainty that there's actually going to be a harmful contact cause because you've set that in motion through the bugs. But in this case, the question is whether or not the award is excessive. So the first case is, are you entitled to the awards? They say no. This case, they say you are entitled to the awards, but did this give you too much? Because you're looking at a $5,000 compensatory judgment and a lot, $186,000 tacked on in punitives. Now, I just want you to alert the fact that there's actually Supreme Court precedents on punitives and excessiveness. Gore versus BMW is a big one. We're going to get to that at the end of the semester. It's in the context of products liability will come out. So realize you can't just look at generic tort law and do punitives. That's that part that excerpt from the opinion. You have to also look at constitutional law, but we're not going to get off on that never-ending rabbit hole trail until later. Okay? So right now we're just focusing on the tort policy principles, and that is proportionality, fair notice, and equality. And so according to Posner, there's certain cases in which punitives really should be permitted. And that is when, first, a case you've got lesser wrongs that cause modest harms. Why would you want a case that's got small wrongs that cause modest harms to potentially get big punitives to it? Yeah?
To discourage the
Yeah, and why do we need to do that? What's about that kind of case that requires such discouragement? What is it about? Like when you get a modest harm with modest damages that require us to start punishing that? Okay, and why would you be left with violence? Because I think we get somewhere before we get to the violent part. Yeah.
I was thinking more like running to the media and absolutely blasting the hotel for every bed rest, and they could absolutely ruin it through that type of thing. I guess that what I would say is that it would be determined for further implications because, you know, we're talking about disease as well, which decides the bugs by any of, I guess.
Well, technically, bed bugs are not actually give different diseases to other people. So that's not going to be an issue. As far as telling the media, the civil liability is not impacted at all. Because unless they settled and had that as part of the settlement disclosure, they're not allowed to communicate with others about what they settled or the nature of the claim, could still tell the media.
But there's something else about, yeah.
Because it's like contrast with like economic breach, and don't want to like just give them the news or just be a story of images. There's some ways to really interact with things. How much money they made on all these other people?
Yes, that's exactly. I mean, the answer out of this, because it's Posner, is going to be economic rationale suggests you need the punitives to deter behavior. That everybody, Posner believes everybody is driven by the dollar. And basically that's it. And so unless there's some dollar reason to adjust your behavior, some economic motivation, you won't do it. And so here, if we give $5,000 to everybody, we're still come out ahead. Why? $5,000 is not nothing. Why aren't we worried about lots and lots and lots of $5,000 suits? Because you figure if we had a lot of $5,000 suits, it would start to become a deterrent effect. The punitive damages are kind of just doing that. They're accelerating that.
Their fees.
No compensation for it. Your contingency fees, what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Contingency.
Yeah, because you get like a third, generally, is what you negotiate out for these kinds of things. You're not going to do an hourly rate for someone who's got a bed bug bite complaint. So basically, any attorney they talk to is likely not going to take this case. It's not worth the expenses to do it. In addition, how often are plaintiffs going to sign up to do this claim? I mean, you get bit by bugs in a hotel. You really want to be like, I want to testify about getting bitten by bugs. I mean, most plaintiffs, I'll tell you, you know, in law schools, law students, I think, incorrectly assume that people are like excited about litigating because we all are. Like, oh, you got this great claim and I know what to do with it. They hate it. They really do. Most people do not want to get on the stand and testify to I got bitten by something that most people think is disgusting. You know, it's something they'd rather keep private. So the reality is a lot of people aren't going to even want to pursue the claim because they're going to feel it's a waste of my time. My bite went away. That's a horrible place. I'm just going to write up something bad about it on a Google or review site, but going to sue is very unlikely. And then the ones that do are never going to get lawyers, so they're not going to be able to deter the claim.
Would you make a good class action?
Damages class actions are highly regulated and would very unlikely become a class action because there's too many things different amongst everybody. There's one common aspect to it, and that has been like the behavior of the company. But you have to say in each situation there's enough differences in behavior that it wouldn't unify it enough to make it a class. Because you have to have certain qualifications in order to be considered a class. And damages, when it's not like when it's not like a remedy you're seeking, it's like injunctive. Damages classes are much harder to meet. Even if we did, we only need it as to like the breaching or causing behavior, and we have to all litigate individually about our damages anyway.
Regarding the compensatory damages, doesn't an insurance company cover those that do not cover?
It depends. Sometimes insurance can cover punitives and sometimes it can't. Some jurisdictions won't permit that. So the law itself will consider that like something that the insurance law will dictate you can't cover, so it just depends. But a lot of times it won't because the sting of the punitives is supposed to go to the person. And if they're able to insure against it, it just kind of is abhorrent. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And moreover, we don't want to be like, take out insurance so you can like murder somebody. You know, it's that whole level of like, this behavior is so bad, we don't want to be able to say, well, I'm just going to insure myself. So go ahead and be deliberately indifferent with respect to all of your harm. You know, so, but some jurisdictions won't permit it. It just depends. You have to look at the insurance law and also the insurance contract. That's all. All right, so that's one aspect that he says definitely should get some attention through punitives. The other ones are when your harms are so unusual that they might be hard to detect. And that's not this case because they knew the bugs were biting them, but sometimes people will do things that they can easily pull the veil over. They can take all the information themselves as defendants, and they can act in a way that makes the plaintiff totally unaware that they've been harmed. Like fraudulent claims are more likely like that, like the business tort claims that we saw I mentioned earlier. Those are ones that often have it. The last is when the criminal law won't deter because either it won't warrant criminal attention or will be able to evade prosecution. Now, that rationale fits in this case because it's very unlikely, like in a civil suit, what you'd be talking about is a suit by the Attorney General's office, and it's fairly unlikely that this particular case would warrant the effort for the Office of the Attorney General to come after this, unless they had an enormous amount of complaints coming. But realize your plaintiffs here are fairly disenfranchised. They don't know each other. They're not likely to be, they're all from different states. They're not likely to come in and say, hey, you know, I really am complaining about this. So none of these rationales, however, support the punitives in national byproduct. The first case we had, if you think about it there, the harm is pretty large. It's really pretty much known to everybody what it was done. It's visible. It isn't something that they're trying to justify their conduct or excuse their behavior. So you're looking at a very different kind of case. So Posner's not trying to talk about every case in which punitives are awarded, but in these types of cases, why there's a justification for punitive damages. All right. So what about the end dollar figure? And we'll kind of wrap up there a little bit early tonight. I'll tell you what I want you to take away from the class here, but what was the actual award? $191,000. How can you speculate they came to that number? Yeah. Yeah, so they said that basically there's 191 rooms, $191,000. We know we're awarding you $5,000 for compensatory, so the remainder is the punitive damage. And in the end, that might be justified. So what do you guys think as far as these two cases? Do you think the punitives were justified in the second case? Yes, no?
A little high, about right. What do you think? What's your take on this?
Okay, so in the
second case, justified?
Absolutely.
Why?
I think deterrence wise is the biggest thing. I mean, you know, want, I mean, potentially, I'm looking at something like that.
Mm-hmm. And even if you didn't, if you think about it, I mean, think about where the plaintiffs, what their position is here. I mean, it's something that we at least all consider as a real invasion of personal dignity. You don't want to go to a hotel, pay them for a place that's safe to stay, shelter. That is really, you know, like that there's something disgusting about it. I mean, because I think bed bugs are not so much that they're infectious or that they're dangerous. Or even aren't that painful. They're just, I mean, gross.
When you do something like that, you show the publicity to the petition of another thing as well.
That's correct. And what you're doing is likely to never come to the attention of someone to correct it. Especially in this case, because they knew over and over and over again that this was a problem. And it wasn't just like, oh gosh, we're behind on our payments, eventually a human gate, oops, they went into the room, someone didn't write the right words on it. Like they wrote, this is the bug room, and they put people deliberately in it, rather than saying, our hotel is no vacancy, which they could have done. So it was like every choice they made, they valued collecting the money from that patron rather than putting the product forward that they actually believed the patron would believe they were getting. Yeah.
And these types of cases would a court ever enforce like, a injunction against the hotel?
Normally in these cases, the plaintiffs aren't seeking injunctive relief. They could have.
They would have to seek.
They have to seek injunctive relief. The court doesn't have the authority just to say this is gross or shutting it down. Now, what would happen would be, like, the Attorney General's office could do that. Any kind of commission or an administrative office that, yeah, and each state has their own different administrative executive offices that oversee things that are sold to the public. So public health. There's also likely a licensing agency amongst the profession that also would be notified and could order those things. You're looking at more like regulatory versus civil judgment. Civil judgment is really about putting the plaintiff's injury back into a normal position where they were before, deterring a little bit based on civil problems.
them as a regulatory agency. And if realizing that that's there, it also is a reason why we don't so readily just give punitives. Because we don't need to use the civil system to regulate behavior. There's other forms of government that can regulate behavior.
Or even economic pressures themselves can regulate behavior. If this is something that it would be very clear that someone would be seriously injured and would have sued if they had been injured, it would be less likely to get punitives because you don't need it. The compensatory judgment itself would deter behavior. But here, the compensatory are maybe 5,000 is actually kind of high, to be real honest. It's just because it's so likely to evade knowledge that's why they did it again.
I actually disagree, and I think that's actually low because in my experience with that bugs and I hate that I'm forced to say that, I've seen whole houses in the market set potentially on fire to get rid of them.
Okay.
But what happens if they do move on? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what I would be seeking in punitive damage. What if I took those bed bugs home and then ruining what, you know, and so that's why I just feel like that.
Well, if it ruins your property, you wouldn't need punitive to actually have compensatories. The problem is, in this case, because they only have 5,000, it arguably was only needed to claim their own property that had been in the hotel, and maybe something, I don't know what else, but, I mean, if you actually did show that your whole house became infested, yeah, we have to resort to cases, I'll say, don't ever pick up furniture left inside the room. There's actually websites about bed bugs, FYI. Well, yeah. But at the same token, like, there is, like, where people will at least alert you where hotels have had regulatory action. So if you're staying in a city, that's just, like, super low report for you. But they are hard. You can understand why this kind of case is one where we would be willing to kind of break out of the mold and give punitive. One more, and then I'll take home for the day.
Struggling to see why each of the cases falls into our first case falls into the one, and the second case falls into the
okay. Well, I think it's easiest to see why the second one is deliberately indifferent, and it's it's not so much that you couldn't be in either. It's just this is a much better way to characterize it, and this isn't sort of like you fit one and only one, or even that you have to fit one of these. What I try to give you is how most jurisdictions talk about different forms of justification. Really, the test is, as we saw in 486, just having, you know, reckless disregard for others or having deliberate indifference. And a lot of times they don't even specify when they look at a case what they're looking at. The only reason I want you to see this is so that you can help yourself in case you're smart.
Is one more severe than the other? So they're equal.
Yeah, and it's not even like you have to say this is deliberate indifference versus wanton disregard for someone else's well-being.
I guess I was visualizing that wanton disregard is more severe than.
No, and in fact, if anything, I mean, I think the fact that you're more aware might, if anything, be worse than the one that you just had a reason to know something. But don't see these two as like elements like we did before. Like, I'm not going to be testing you and necessarily say, is this wanton disregard or is this deliberate indifference? This is more of, I think your casebook in one situation here is a little lack in what most courts will use to describe this. And so that's all that is. It's not like an element, it's not like you have to prove one or the other. It's just that that's typically the vernacular you'll see. Where they just kind of say, reckless disregard or gross negligence is what they really mean. Yeah, but it's not like a hard test.
I thought it fits in this category.
Right. Yeah, and arguably when I suggested that it's a better example of one or the other, that's probably what it made you think, but I don't mean it that way. I don't mean it as you have to fit one or the other, that they're like hard tests to apply. So what do you take away from this? In the end, punitive is very rarely awarded, that you have to show something more than negligence, and you should be able to at least articulate what those mores are. And you can do it either through using these two words, you know, like these two different definitions, or using the standards you see on 486, but it's more than just negligence. Okay?
What was the third thing you said? Very rare. Unless you want to negligence.
I don't know what it was like that. All right. Oh, just you should be able to describe, you know, how it works. Like, what's more than negligence? I don't really see it as three. I really probably see it as two. Very rarely awarded. This is how it is, and it can be either just scan 46 or as these two things. But be able to describe and connect them. We're going to add a third later, which is going to be the excessiveness piece under Gore, under the constitutionality, which you don't have yet. So that's all.
Sometimes gross negligence can cause.
Yes. Okay, anything else? All right, I'll see you on Monday. I mean, I'll see you next Friday, actually. Sorry.